It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Pundits are already calling 2013 the least productive year in congressional history. Even if Congress accomplishes everything on its to-do list before the end of the year, this Congress will be remembered more for what it didn't get done.
So how did we get here? Where does this inaction come from? Our guest this half hour says the trend has developed partly because of party polarization, and he's here to talk about how that has developed over time. Jonathan Pollack is with us. He is a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. And John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So let's talk about the idea of the least productive year in congressional history. You know, in the history of the Republic, that's pretty big talk. Is it true?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly down there in the least productive years. I think, there are always kind of phases of a gridlock in Congress. When you've got divided government, when you've got the president who's a member of one party, or you have the Senate under, as we have this in this session, Democratic control, and the House under Republican control. So that's a fairly consistent thing. There have been other periods of gridlock. But what I think makes this Congress different and is a real sea change in American politics in the 21st century over earlier periods of time is the degree of party unity. That this was something, you know, when I started my teaching career about 20 years ago, I used to tell my students that really in American politics, there's more difference within each party than between them, that ultimately there was sort of a middle ground between the Democrats and Republicans that presidential candidates ran toward, and that leaders of both parties in Congress kind of staked out that position to bring things together and get legislation passed. And what we've seen, especially in the last 20 years or so, and really accelerated since about 2009, is a real kind of unity among each party. That it used to be there were different flavors of Democrat or different flavors of Republican depending on where you were in the United States, and that both parties had their liberal and conservative wings. And we've moved to a much more unified kind of party where to be a Democrat in Wisconsin is pretty much what it's like to be a Democrat in Florida or Washington State. And to be a Republican in Wisconsin is like being a Republican in Georgia or a Republican in Arizona. And so with the lack of diversity within each party, the natural result is the people who would gravitate toward the middle, who would broker compromises, who would try to get legislation passed. That's just not happening.
So any idea why this occurred? I mean, because it seems like you were saying that, you know, years past, a lot of the debate we saw was within parties themselves on whatever the issue of the day was. Now, as you point out, it seems as though if you are a Democrat, you toe the party line. If you're a Republican, you toe the party line, or there's going to be trouble to pay for you as a member of that party down the line. Somebody will find somebody to run against you in a primary somewhere. So why do you think that happened? Is it an evolution in the party structure where it became politics is more all or nothing? Or it was just a natural sort of thing?
Well, I think there's kind of we can look from like a national level down and we can look from a state level up.
Mm-hmm.
So from a state level up, both parties have done in most states, because not all states have this, but in most states, you take the census and then the Congress that's elected like 2 years after, the state legislature that's elected 2 years after divides up how the districts work, and that's how we do things in Wisconsin. And the rise of big data, the rise of quantification, the ability to identify potential voters has enabled really both parties to create districts whereas people say the parties pick their voters instead of vice versa. So if you create relatively homogenous districts where it's very difficult, where you've got a heavily Republican district, a heavily Democratic district, where the races just aren't going to be competitive, where there's a very slim chance that that voters in that particular district are going to, you know, deviate from their party tradition, then what happens is all the action comes in the primary. And so in a Republican district, people compete to see who's like the most Republican, in a Democratic district, who's the most Democratic. And as a result, people who are kind of on the fence, who say, well, yeah, I agree with National Democrats most of the time, but I really disagree with this, or vice versa on the Republican side, they're the ones who get zoned out. They don't make it through the primary. So that's kind of the bottom-up version. And the top-down version I think it's due to like the rise of 24-hour news cycles. That in a 24-hour news cycle, you're constantly looking for material to put on air. And, you know, in the limited experience I have actually like behind the microphone in journalism and sort of studying the history of journalism and so on, is that, you know, the bias in journalism is really toward action. You know, there's a bias toward action. Like stuff that's boring does not get broadcast. It does not get – certainly doesn't get aired on television. And stuff that's exciting does. And so if you want to build your career as a politician, you know, it's easier to do that. The idea of building a career as the person who behind the scenes brings people together quietly out of the spotlight on the QT, well, if it's secret, it's not getting on television. It's not getting the airtime. It's not getting the guest shots on Jon Stewart, or you're not getting on Sean Hannity or anything like that. You're just kind of like in the background. Whereas if you're a fire breather, if you're the person who makes these, you know, big, bold statements before a friendly crowd, before an audience, you know, drummed up by a think tank that supports your ideological perspective, then that makes television. You know, if somebody's saying something outrageous and an audience of people cheering, you know, people will comment on that online. They'll stop what they're doing to take a look at it. So I think that's kind of the national picture trickling down, that you've got both those forces putting pressure on politicians to act a certain way to kind of depart from this idea of behind the scenes compromise and people saying, OK, we can agree to disagree on this. I'll take this. You take that. That's boring to look at. Negotiations are not as fun to watch as big blanket statements.
And compromise is not as interesting to write about if you're a reporter. One of the things that you point out as kind of a turning point in this whole idea of compromise becoming a dirty word happened at the 2009 State of the Union address. And we've got a clip here that we'd like to play from that. And so here's the deal. It's the 2009 State of the Union address. President Obama is giving it, and this is what we hear.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally. It's not true.
And there we go. Representative Joe Wilson there in the background. You lie is what he... Why is this such an important moment in the history of all this?
Well, when I first ran across that clip, what it reminded me of was a show that my roommates and I watched occasionally in college late at night on C-SPAN.
Wow,
pretty crazy stuff going on. It was a televised sessions of Parliament called Question Time, where it's a British custom where people can just ask the Prime Minister, members of Parliament ask the Prime Minister just really blunt questions. And it's this really kind of confrontational sort of questioning we didn't really have in the United States. I mean, if you watch like Senate proceedings and so forth, they're full of the, you know, my esteemed colleague, the junior senator from Colorado, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's couched in this very kind of elegant language. But Question Time is just super blunt. And I remember watching this and finding it kind of funny that, you know, they could just ask their prime minister that. And that ties into, the difference between the British government and ours. It's a parliamentary system. In a parliamentary system, the prime minister is the head of the party in the way that the president isn't traditionally in the United States. There's a chair of the Republican Party. There's a chair of the Democratic Party that aren't elected officials, that are party officials. But one of the effects of this polarization in American politics is it makes American parties more like political parties in parliamentary systems, where they've got a consistent and sort of narrower set of goals and ideas. And where that's kind of weird in the American system is that parliamentary democracies typically have at least three parties that get votes that elect people to office in fairly large numbers. And in the U.S., of course, we have this really entrenched two-party system that it's been very difficult for third parties to take off. There's even in these times, there's not really much of a serious momentum building for a third-party movement even now.
Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be taking some of your calls. We're talking to history expert Jonathan Pollack right now about the rise of political polarization in Congress in Wisconsin and throughout the nation.
We want to know what you think about this, too. What do you think is driving the political inaction and the partisanship that we're seeing today? What needs to change in order to stop some of the intense polarization statewide and across the nation? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking about the rise of political gridlock in Congress, Wisconsin, and nationwide with Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think is behind all of this? And what would you like to see changed? Are you optimistic that things can change? And how? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@WPR.org or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We've got some calls lined up. Before we go to those, though, Jonathan Pollack, well, one of the questions I wanted to ask was about the election of Barack Obama in 2008 and whether you think that that changed kind of the formula in terms of gridlock, because it seems as though it's been around for a while, but it also seems as though it took a turn for locking up a little more after that election.
Yeah, I think that gridlock has really increased since Obama came into office. And I think there are a few reasons. First of all, I think coming off of George W. Bush's two terms in office and his relative popularity for his wars and so forth while he was in office, I think there was a sense among Republicans in the United States that the Republican dynasty was pretty much sealed, that this was a done deal and really kind of had been since the age of Ronald Reagan. And that to have Obama come and also in the, you know, remember when Obama ran for president in 2008, Hillary Clinton was the front runner early on. I mean, everyone knew, oh, it's going to be Hillary Clinton again. And Clinton, honestly, was, you know, he took a lot of plays out of the Republican playbook while he was president. A lot of people compared his policies to Richard Nixon's. So Hillary Clinton was like a candidate Republicans could sort of imagine. Obama seemed to come out of nowhere. And I think that was profoundly puzzling. And at the same time, on the Democratic side, lots of people voted for Obama who hadn't been engaged voters before, that Obama brought a lot of people into politics who had not thought of themselves as following politics especially closely, and they were huge fans. So this groundswell of voters who seemed to come out of nowhere and a candidate who wasn't as well known prompted Republicans to kind of, you know, retreat a little bit and try to figure out who he was.
Let's go to the phones right now. We've got a call from Alex, who joins us from Stoughton. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. My question for the guest is, I guess more, I would like for him to comment on some research that I ran across in school, saying that when the majority party is redistricting in a state, they actually tend not to put a supermajority of people, but just a simple majority of, you know, whether Republicans or Democrats. So that way they can include more of the other party and sort of eliminate their representation by having someone from, you know, the Republican or Democratic Party against them. So I was wondering if the guest could comment on that, if he's run across any similar research that says that, you know, just because you've redistricted doesn't mean that it's a done deal for a single party, because a lot of those, because of 51%, have switched over to other parties in elections following the redistricting. And then also sort of my theory to sort of replace that, if it is false, is to say that people really just want these sort of angry, vitriolic candidates because they believe that they're going to fight for them when really all they're doing is fighting and they're not building consensus.
All right, Alex, thanks for the call. A couple of things there. Redistricting, of course. Man, that's been all over the place in Wisconsin lately.
Yeah, I mean, I think redistricting, there are definitely districts that wind up being roughly even or that have a slight majority and so forth. I mean, it varies depending on the individual state house, and it varies around the state. I mean, even with the quantitative tools that are available now to party officials and the attorneys who focus on election law, they can't guarantee landslides in every district. There are going to be some districts that wind up more or less even. But quite a few people do wind up kind of zoned into those, into districts that are going to go with a pretty solid majority of one party or another. Though I don't, you know, I'm not enough of a political scientist and a quantoid to say how many it is of each. On to the second point about voters wanting this kind of confrontational style. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I think that, you know, before we sit here and point fingers and say, oh, it's a horrible thing that politics is so divisive, and why don't candidates willing to compromise win? Gene, I think you had mentioned that a little bit in some of your comments earlier, that that it, you know, there's really no incentive to be that compromiser, that the impetus for that comes from, like, editorial page boards. It comes from talking heads on Sunday morning television, Sunday morning news programming. And outside of that, people might say, oh, yeah, we kind of want that sort of stable compromise consensus building sort of candidate. But actually, given like the excitement of an election season and being in a voting booth during a primary time, the compromise candidates look kind of milquetoast. And people say, like you said, Alex, we want somebody who's going to get in there and fight for us.
Are there ebbs and flows in American politics in terms of this kind of compromise, not compromise, that sort of thing? And could we argue that maybe we're just in one of those times right now, and somehow the pendulum will swing back the other way?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. I'd say it's an especially intense swing in this direction at this moment. But, you know, if you look at moments of political realignment, you look at like after 1964, where the Civil Rights Act prompted many of the Southern Democrats to leave the Democratic Party and join the Republicans. And the kind of polarizing force of Barry Goldwater's campaign, that he was, you know, he knocked off Nelson Rockefeller in the primary, who was like a classic middle-of-the-road liberal Republican. And Goldwater's campaign initially, people said, oh, this is polarizing. It resulted in a terrible electoral loss for Goldwater. And yet the people who came up on the Goldwater campaign a generation later, starting in the 1980s, wound up in the House and Senate and at state in state positions at all levels. So I think there's definitely those kind of ebbs and flows. As I mentioned, this cycle looks different because it seems more intense in some ways. You know, just the sheer paucity of bills passed out of this Congress is a big part of that. But it is definitely cyclical.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Ron is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, Ron.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Like I was telling the screener, I think you have to have your head in the sand to make believe that this president being black and the first black African-American president doesn't have something to do with this polarization.
Ron, thanks for the call. We were talking a little bit about that earlier, Jonathan Pollock. And is it a matter of race or is there more to it than that?
I think race is at the heart of a lot of it. I would contend that for some of Obama's opponents, it's not race at a conscious level. But when you're talking about the history of racism, there's so much that's below the surface of consciousness. There's so much that's just kind of ingrained with people, where they go to stereotypes without really thinking about it. And I agree with the caller on that one, that I think the fact that Obama's black has a great deal to do with that. And at the same time, I think one of the reasons that Obama seems often kind of baffled by the blowback that he gets for doing things that are relatively innocuous is that he's, you know, he had a really unusual upbringing. You know, he was not especially close to the black side of his family, to his father and to their family. That he had an education at an elite private school in Honolulu, excellent universities for college and law school. So he was kind of insulated from some of that day-to-day racism that most African-Americans run into. Ultimately, I think that's a huge part of it, that there's a slice of the electorate that still can't quite get over the fact we elected a black president.
You know, as you listen to, if you read editorial pages, if you read columns of one kind or another, there's sort of a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth about the polarization that we see, about this gridlock. Is the period that we're in right now, is it in and of itself a bad thing?
You mean the polarization? Is the polarization
Yeah, I mean,
a bad thing?
Is gridlock bad? I mean, so we're not doing anything good. Well, we're not doing anything bad either, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one way to look at it. I mean, if you, you know, if you're relatively optimistic about the current state of mm-hmm. things, if the status quo works for you, then yeah, gridlock is just fine. And in other periods of gridlock, you know, people have said that that Wall Street, that other corporate interests in the U.S. really want gridlock to be a thing. If Congress is fighting each other, they're not actually going out and passing laws, heaven forbid. At the same time, if you look around at the United States and you look at income inequality, you look at student loan debt, you look at other solvable problems that are out there, then gridlock's extremely frustrating. That you know, you're yearning for some kind of solution. There are facts of life that are painfully evident to people once they step foot outside their houses or don't. And if Congress is too busy kind of making talking points and puffing themselves up on talk shows and stuff like that to actually get down to the business of governing, that's super frustrating.
Well, John, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for calling me up.
We appreciate it. That was Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.